Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's Crime Beat show presents special guest tonight, Julia Burke from Hollywood, California. Julia Burke is a former Customs and Border Protection agent and national security whistleblower. She'll discuss her case against the Department of Homeland Security as well as national security issues. It's going to be a fascinating, great broadcast tonight, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer and the sleuth of all sleuths, the unflappable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ronnie's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director, publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released award-winning documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's Strategic Media Books, www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert in the fascinating world of crime. Also, be sure to visit his website. That's www.ronchepsik. And you can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, William. First, we're going to make a correction. It's Julia Davis, not Julia Burke. Susan Burke was our guest last week, Willie.
And we apologize. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon.
We apologize. It was a little Freudian slip there. I guess we could call it that if you want. So anyways, thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who's assisted me on some of my crime books. He's currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. He has a couple of books coming out. One is out now called Movers and Mavericks. Another one next year on the Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks, Ronnie. And again, my apologies. It's Julia Davis. Now, just before I reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received over the last couple of weeks, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the globe for tuning into Crime Beat. And, you know, we've got over 140,000 listeners every week, and from over 120 countries around the globe. So I think we're doing something right, Ronnie. Also, a special thank you to the Ryan Brothers for allowing to use their great music for our theme song. It's got the beat to crime written all over it. Like I said many times, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're on the cutting edge of internet radio. Well, Ronnie, now here's this week's mailbag. This one is from Victoria of San Diego, California. Victoria writes, "It's about time someone stepped up to the plate to wave the flag about women rape victims in the U.S. military. Susan Burke has hero written all over her. I'm a victim myself, but never had the courage to talk about it. I will be now." Now, this one, Ronnie, is from Patricia of Anchorage, Alaska, way up there in Alaska. Patricia writes, "The commanding officers that lend a blind eye to the vile culture of rape in the military should all be court-martialed, lined up, and shot like the Romanov family." Great show, guys. Hey, Ronnie, pretty strong comments.
Right.
What's your thoughts about these?
I agree with Patricia's sentiment. I agree with Patricia's sentiment. It was one of the most shocking interviews I've ever done. And, you know, I was speechless there a couple of times. You know how hard that is to to do that, to make me speechless. And
you bet.
I mean, it's just amazing. There's no accountability in the military. I mean, the fox is guarding the hen house. You have the military investigating these rapes, and hopefully that STOP Act Susan talked about that's in Congress right now will pass. And we urge our listeners to go out there and write their congressmen and to support this act, because it's very important. We got to deal with this pernicious problem in the U.S. military. Will we?
Absolutely. She's a real crusader, and good for her. We'll keep an eye on all her stuff that she's doing out there for the cause. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide, wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please.
Right. We have another great show with Mara Shalhoub, who'll be talking about her book, BMF, The Rise and Fall of Big Meech and the Black Mafia Family. The Black Mafia Family, BMF, was a big, huge drug trafficking organization in Detroit. It's an amazing story, an amazing investigation by the authorities, and we're really looking forward to that show next week, Willie.
Yeah, that's going to be an exciting show. I'm really looking forward to that one. Now, Roddy, tell our listeners out there what you've been doing and what you're up to in the next week or two.
Well, we got a couple of great things, exciting things going on. I'm going to be on the Bio Channel and Gangsters, America's Most Evil. They rescheduled the show from September 25th to September 18th, and I'll be on two segments that same day. I don't know why they're doing the same day, but they are. One on Lethal Beauties and the other on Queen Pins. And, of course, I did one of my books is called Queen Pins.
Yeah.
Notorious Woman Gangsters of the Modern Era, so that's why I was invited on the show. And our Frank Matthews doc, we have a deal in the works with a TV station, and hopefully it'll be on the air pretty soon. So it's pretty exciting things coming up for me. Willie?
Absolutely. Well, you're doing great, Ronnie. Thanks a lot. I've been following you for many, many moons, more moons than you'd care to know. But like I said, you're going places, and congratulations there, buddy.
Yeah.
Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present a rap sheet part of the program. A rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from around the world and crime news you might have missed. Now, here is rap sheet item number one. Dateline, August 16th, 2012. Los Angeles, California. Federal court clerk caught selling information. Hey, Ronnie, in a shocking security breach, a federal court, get this, a federal court clerk in Los Angeles has been charged with selling information from sealed court documents. Hey, Ronnie, what on earth is going on? Is nothing sacrosanct in the courtroom anymore, buddy? What's going on?
I'm just shocked that corruption is going on in the L.A. federal courtroom. I'm telling you, just this story is deja vu all over again. This woman who was the clerk that sold the information did it for $2,000. And the really weird thing is that the person that gave the information to the snitch that turned on them was actually a felon. He had been serving fraud, so they don't vet their federal employees too much in the L.A. courthouse on that, and which could be a real serious problem. You know, if you've got sealed records.
Yeah,
and you may have informants' names that want to get out, and somebody wants to sell that information. It could be a really serious situation. So I don't know if they're going to get their act together after this or not, but it's shocking.
It is nothing sacred anymore. What this has to be looked at and it's corrected all over the place in the court system in the U.S. Now here is rap sheet item number two, Dateline, August 1st. 2012, Vancouver, British Columbia. RCMP women officers file harassment class action suit. Hey, Ronnie, hundreds of current and former female Mounties have come forward from across Canada to join a class action lawsuit alleging harassment within the ranks of the RCMP. Hey, Ronnie, they were your heroes, buddy. You know, this is a new take on the Mounties always get their men. Hey,
right,
any comment?
Mounties always get their men. You know, as a kid growing up in Thunder Bay, Canada, I wanted to be a Mountie at one time. They're a really revered institution, but this is just there's dozens of lawsuits coming out of this situation, not just this one, but this is a class action lawsuit, so it's gotten more attention, and so we're talking about hundreds, perhaps thousands of incidents, and it looks like what we were talking about last week. Some of these women are reporting post-traumatic stress syndrome. know, just like the military woman who was serving in the military, and some of this harassment went over 20 years. You know, some of these women. So it's an issue that's going to be around for a while, and we'll follow it. And if it does continue, we'll get somebody on the air to talk about it. Right.
Absolutely. It's a very fascinating, intriguing story, and we hope all the ladies in the RCMP get their desserts on this one, because they deserve it.
Right.
But anyway, we'll keep an eye on that story. Now, just before we get on to our very special guest tonight, Julia Davis, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat this evening. You can listen to all our broadcasts on the Internet band at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening, so if you missed one, you can check us out anytime. If you have any questions for our guests, you can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll also be glad to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Julia Davis, former Customs and Border Protection Officer at San Ysidro Port of Entry, south of San Diego, California. The port of entry is the largest and busiest land border crossing in the U.S. and in the world, as a matter of fact. Julia Davis will talk about homeland security and national security issues. It's going to be a great show. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Julia Davis.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. You're in Hollywood right now, right?
Yes, I am.
What are you doing?
We're getting ready for the American film market that is coming up this year, where we'll be presenting a lot of projects, and many of them actually related to the plight of whistleblowers and government corruption. Thank you.
Right, that's very interesting. I'm thinking about going to that myself, so maybe we could meet and introduce ourselves. But you've got an award-winning documentary, Top Priority, The Terror Within. It debuted last May. Congratulations on that documentary. I understand it debuted at the premiered at the Academy of Motion Pictures, Art and Sciences.
Yes, that's correct. We premiered this summer at the Academy, and have also followed by theatrical release in New York and Los Angeles. And now we're working on continuing our release nationwide, and to be followed later this year by release on DVD as well.
Okay, great. We'll talk a little bit about it later, and how our audience can now or eventually get access to it. But you were falsely accused of being a domestic terrorist, and I've seen photos of you. You don't look like a domestic terrorist. And I looked at your background, and you've got a really interesting background. Maybe you should go into your background first, and we'll lead up to the incident that led to all the problems that have resulted for you and your family. So your master's degree in aviation and spacecraft engineering, and you also are involved with films and television projects, right? How did you get involved with all of that?
When I was studying engineering in where I was actually, I was born and spent the first 22 years of my life in Kiev, Ukraine. And when I was studying engineering, I was also working at the film studio that was right across the street from the university. And that's where I met my husband, who came there from the U.S. to film a movie. And the first day we met, our eyes met, and we were inseparable ever since, and I've been together for 18 years now.
Wow.
And when I came to the U.S., I continued to work in the film industry with him. And but after 9/11, I saw myself doing something more and trying to do something for my nation of the United States, and went into the federal law enforcement.
That's really interesting. Before we talk about that part of your career, the thing that really stands out, given our celebrity obsessed culture, is you were a stunt double for Angelina Jolie, and I got to mention that, or we couldn't move on. Tell us a little bit about that. How did that happen?
When I worked with my husband, he started his career as a stuntman. He still has two standing world records for high falls from helicopter into the water, and So he started his career doing stunts and progressed to being a stunt coordinator and director and producer. So when I started my film career alongside with my husband, he got me into doing stunts, and I ended up doubling Angelina Jolie, Helen Hunt, and doing, you know, all kinds of fun things on the movie set that involved stunts, and then also progressed to writing and producing and directing from there. And Angelina Jolie and Helen Hunt were perhaps the most famous people that I doubled, and my husband also doubled five Academy Award winners. So it's been a very interesting, colorful ride.
Right, right. You really led an adrenaline rush, I would say, given all the events that have transpired in your life. But you came to Department of Homeland Security, right? And what did you do there? And did it meet your expectations when you came there?
When I first came there, I found the job to be challenging and interesting, but the more I worked there, the more I noticed the futility of the way the system was set up. There was no real concern about what the mission of the agency states. It was more for the people in position of power to maintaining their position and creating an impression that the system works and that the borders are being protected. And in reality, when Tom Ridge was telling American people that borders were 50% more safe, they were removing x-rays and metal detectors from the border, and that's never been explained why that was done. And then when I tried to address it with the Homeland Security personnel and then White House people, and, you know, I went to through every avenue that there was, and it seemed like no one cared. And their main objective was just to look good instead of doing good.
Right, right. And you uncovered, it reached a head when you uncovered this national security breach, right, at that port of entry near San Diego. And tell us a little bit about that. What happened, and how did you discover this serious national security breach?
We had very specific alerts that we have received briefings that Al-Qaeda members were planning to come into the United States through the land borders with Mexico on 4th of July. You know how symbolism is very important to terrorists. So that's what we were told. We were given a list of special dates to watch, and 4th of July was pointed out as the date to watch of special importance. And when I came into work, I was acting supervisor that day on my shift, and part of my job was to take the paperwork from the previous shift and put every entry of applicants into the Homeland Security database. So when I started doing that, I started seeing one after another people from terrorist countries, to the point where at the end of me putting in all the data in the system, there were 23 that had been admitted in a 10-hour period, where normally at that port we would get maybe 15 to 20 people in an entire month. So the numbers were obviously very high, and we had a special alert. And when I looked at the paperwork, they didn't even bother to run fingerprints of those people, to run their names through any systems. They didn't do any checks, and it seemed like someone just flushed them across the border without any scrutiny. So I took the paperwork and brought it to the port director on my shift, and I asked him, did you know that this had happened, because we were supposed to be looking for exactly this type of thing. And he said he hadn't heard about it, and he said, take it to Intel. When I went to Intel, I couldn't believe my eyes, and I found a locked door because they were all given a day off for 4th of July barbecuing. So on this date of special importance, there was no intel on duty. And the port director didn't really want to do anything from that point on and told me just leave it in their box. They'll get to it when they get to it. But our manual said that if anything terrorism-related happens on your watch, you are supposed to notify Joint Terrorism Task Force with the FBI. Right. And that's exactly what I did. I called them and I said, you might want to look into this. Something suspicious may have happened, and they asked for a written report, which I had provided, and from that point on, my life was never the same.
Wow. So you were following protocol, and makes you almost wonder if these guys were working for Al-Qaeda within our national security apparatus, because you know, the way you describe it, I mean, they should really just have looked into it right off the bat.
Exactly. And, you know, actually, people, even the at the top levels of the agency, including a former port director from the San Ysidro Port of Entry, have been arrested and prosecuted for taking bribes for letting people in that shouldn't have been admitted into the country, people and drugs. So, those were going off in my head that maybe someone was on the take letting those people in, or maybe there was some other agenda,
right.
Or, you know, it could also have been incompetence and someone being lazy. But, you know, there's a number of possibilities, and I believe that they needed to be looked into. But instead, they started to look into me.
Well, you don't see much, I haven't anyways, reports about the corruption within Homeland Security. It sounds like it's a real serious problem, right?
It is a very serious problem. There are a large number of arrests and prosecutions, and the mainstream media doesn't like to really concentrate on that. And I've discovered that when I was discussing my case with the mainstream media, that was the first reaction, well, it's unpatriotic to talk about Homeland Security's shortcomings, because people are already, you know, resisting TSA, and they're not happy about it, and it's just not politically correct.
Right. Yeah, Oscar Wilde said patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you know, on that. So we had the situation. You know, have we been lucky? You know, given this serious internal problem, that we haven't been really hit again with a huge attack.
I think that it's it's just been kind of laying dormant, because when I read about the cases that are being prosecuted, it seems to me like a lot of those cases revolve around FBI agents that incite people to go along with their plan, where the FBI goes so far as to even build the explosive device and then give it to somebody to say, okay, go and do it, just to pretty much give an impression that cases are being prosecuted. But in reality, they seem to be manufacturing cases instead of prosecuting them. So it's not a good situation. There's a lot of appearances that the public is being given. And, thank God that nothing has happened since then. But it's the way things are being handled, we're in a potentially dangerous situation.
Yeah. Hey, Ronnie, I got a quick
one
for Julia. Yeah, Julia, the policy with Homeland Security today is basically if you see something, say something. And it's a campaign right across the United States. It encourages citizens to be vigilant when there's a potential terrorist activity or a sign of terrorism. How should the average citizen report this activity? Any comments on that?
Right, that's a good point, because they may report it, but nothing's going to happen. I mean, the way you describe the situation, Julia.
Yes, and I think that's largely the hypocrisy of it all, is that they encourage people to do this, but they don't really give very clear guidelines as to what they're supposed to do. And it seems to me like this is created more as an apparatus to encourage people to make reports against each other, or maybe the neighbor that they don't like, or the system that could potentially be used to arrest somebody and say, well, we've received an anonymous report, and you'll never know if there was a report or not, but they will have some way of saying, well, under this system, we got a report, so we're going to scoop you up and go see what we can find in your home. So it's a two-edged sword. The way it's promoted right now, I don't see that it's a real tool for citizens to report.
Yeah.
Right. It's not very well organized.
Well, eventually the media did get wind of the story, right, with respect to your report to the FBI, and that must have infuriated the bureaucrats that were above you. not following up on it. And so tell us a little bit what happened then when the story started to get out.
Well, the main thing that that they were trying to prevent is exactly that, is preventing the story from getting out. And what happened after I made the report is within a couple of weeks, I found myself the subject of 19 investigations.
Wow.
And every day I come into work, I'd be served with a notice of another investigation. And it just, it's gotten to the point where I knew that they were trying to get rid of me and do it in a way where they could try to discredit me, to say, well, she's a bad officer. Look, she's under investigation.
Right.
And they had, it's gotten to such a point where I've decided to involuntarily resign, which means that I did not want to resign, but they had forced me into such a position where I knew that working there would be untenable. So as soon as I resigned, I filed a lawsuit against the Homeland Security.
Right.
And I prevailed in that lawsuit, and that's really when the media exposure came in at the same time. And a couple of weeks after I prevailed against them in the lawsuit is when they landed the Black Hawk helicopter and stormed my home with a special response team.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about that, but we're talking about right now faceless bureaucrats. But let's name some names: Herbert Coffer, right, and Jeffrey Deal were the two individuals with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE agents that were coordinating a series of unlawful actions against you. Is that correct?
That's correct, and they were sanctioned by a former Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, Robert Bonner, who was also involved in the Challenger disaster. So covering up bad media coverage is definitely one of his specialties.
Right. And are they still with ICE?
They are still working for the Homeland Security. Deal has been moved to Customs and Border Protection. And Coffer is still with ICE, and both of them have been promoted.
Wow. Well, let's take a break before we talk about some of these incidents, and our listeners will be really shocked when they hear some of the things that were done against Julia and her family. Willie, go ahead,
Absolutely.
Please.
Absolutely, yeah. We'll do a fascinating interview this evening with Julia Davis. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network, with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Our very special guest this evening is Julia Davis. Now back to Ron and Julia.
Right. And Julia, you're associated with the Whistleblowers Association, right, Center? And I'm going to give the website for that for people that want to check out to the good work that's being done by the organization. It's www.whistleblowers.org. And you have a blog too, Julia, right?
I write for the Los Angeles Homeland Security Examiner, and there's also a website for the film, which is toppriorymovie.com.
And I think the blog site is Julia Davis. It's davisnews.blogspot.com. JuliaDavisNews.blogspot.com. And the movie itself, I guess, goes into a great description about what you've been talking about on our show, right, Julia?
Yes, definitely.
Right, and what's your role in that, in the documentary?
Well, I wrote it and also helped produce it, and it includes interviews with me and all the other key participants in the case, including the perpetrators, whom we had videotaped during their court deposition.
Right. And when will the public be able to get it on DVD, do you think?
I think later this year. We're presenting it at the American Film Market this year, and I believe that sometime during this autumn it should be released nationwide on DVD.
Right, and so people will be able to go to your website, the website, to check out the information. We're talking about, generally about the investigations, and you said 19. I ran across a report that said it eventually ended up to be a total of 54 investigations against you. And And some of the things were just amazing. And you could talk about them. I'll just mention a couple of things. They conducted warrantless searches of your home and office. Your husband and yourself were put in jail twice, false imprisonments. You had they're maliciously prosecuted, and there was wiretaps and privacy in violations. Talk a little bit about some of the things anecdotally, and then the impact on your family.
When even after I left the agency, we noticed that we were still under surveillance, even when we had mentioned it to our friends and attorneys, it was difficult for them to imagine. So we had documented it throughout our case, and later in the lawsuit, we had a good laugh when we read a report where Homeland Security agents were complaining to each other, saying targets are very surveillance savvy and have been photographing our agents that are following them. So they spent millions in taxpayers' resources following us on foot, by vehicle, and they even sent a fixed-wing airplane from San Diego to Palm Springs to fly over our home to conduct surveillance. They also did surveillance on the Black Hawk helicopter, and that was before they raided the home. Subsequently, and they also used the OnStar, even though we had disconnected that service a year earlier, for $150 an hour. OnStar is happy to turn over with no court order of any kind the information about your whereabouts, to track you and to activate passive listening within your car where the microphone is being activated, although you don't know about it, so they can hear whatever you're talking about inside your vehicle.
Well, this seems like it's really personal. What kind of relationship did you have with Coffer and Deal? Leading up to the incident.
I did not know them at all, but
you didn't know them at all?
No, when my report to the FBI was sent to Commissioner Bonner for action, because the press started asking him questions about Julie Davis's report. And we got all of these documents in court proceedings. Bonner sent a directive to ICE, which is essentially serving as internal affairs for Customs and Border Protection, and they asked them all information about Julia Davis and is she under any investigation. And they wrote him back saying, no, she's not under any investigation. And literally what he told them was, start investigating her. And at the end, it was 54 investigations that we know of with specific case numbers and dates and all of that information. So instead of protecting the borders, this is the kind of things that they've been doing for years.
Right. It seems like it's unbridled power. They are powers unto themselves, and they pretty well could do anything they wanted to do under the guise of national security. Is that a correct assessment?
It is, and that's why they had classified me as a domestic terrorist, and their reason for doing so was to say they considered me a domestic terrorist for anti-government statements in my lawsuits and press articles. So under that classification, you guys would also qualify, and they could pretty much throw it out there, and then they believe that just saying so gave them the authority for warrantless searches, for warrantless seizures, and warrantless surveillance, and they thought it untied their hands to do whatever they wanted.
Wow. Well, is that when you went to the Whistleblower Association? You must have felt helpless. Where did you go to get some kind of help to deal with this harassment?
Well, when we were going through this and we were in courts dealing with the agency and working to fight false criminal charges, and once we prevailed, then we were suing the Homeland Security. No one would help us at that point. We had gone to ACLU. We turned to Government Accountability Project, Project on Government Oversight. We had gone to a lot of people, and the response every time was that, well, you're doing the right things. You already got attorneys, so good luck to you. And so no one helped. And pretty much the way the system is set up, unless there's already big media coverage, pretty much no one's going to step up and help you. So
Wow, you're really by yourself against the system when it's out of control. That's shocking. But you know, this not only affected you and your husband. Describe what happened to your parents.
When Homeland Security raided our home on August 10, 2005, they saw my mom outside watering the plants, and they assumed that she was me. So they gave the go-ahead saying the target is there. So 27-man special response team, which is essentially a SWAT team, and a helicopter descended on the house where only my elderly parents were at home. My husband and I were not at home at the time. And they had brutalized them. My dad came out of the house to see why they were beating the doors in with a battering ram to tell them, you know, because they were trying to break down.
They didn't have a warrant. They didn't have a warrant?
No, they didn't have a search warrant. They had obtained an indictment against us on immigration charges that we later proved were completely bogus, but they did not have a search warrant. And
they can do that without a search warrant, and it's legal.
Yes. It technically isn't. If they only have an arrest warrant and the person that they're trying to arrest is not at home, they're not supposed to set foot inside of home. But and after 2 years of surveillance, instead of going for the front door that was actually unlocked, they went with a battering ram and started beating down the bedroom door of the house and beat a huge hole through them. But the doors opened to the outside, but they kept beating them inward and couldn't get in even after they had made the huge hole through the door. So if it wasn't tragic, it would be pretty comical. It was like Keystone Cops. And my dad came out through the open front door to ask them, well, what is going on? What are you guys doing? And instead of answering him, they converged on him and threw him face down on a cement floor so hard that they broke his finger and handcuffed him and shackled him and dragged him down the steps. We have a tall set of steps outside the house.
Wow.
They dragged him down the steps and Palm Springs at that time of the year, it was August, it was 117 degrees. And my dad was wearing nothing but boxer shorts, and so they have him sitting barefoot, not wearing any clothes other than his underwear, in full desert sun. He's handcuffed and shackled, and they knew that he has a heart condition because before they raided the house, their reports showed that they knew that my elderly parents would be there and that my dad had a heart condition. So I think that this was very much pre-planned because they knew how close I was to my dad, and they knew how much I loved him, so they wanted to cause him to have a heart attack, which they did, because every time he would ask them what is going on, why he's being handcuffed, they would tell him, your daughter is a domestic terrorist. So in his mind, he was obviously at that point thinking, what is going on with me in the meantime?
Right.
If they're saying I'm a terrorist, and he kept asking for water and medication, and they just laughed at him. And there was an ambulance that they had stationed across the road for the raid, as part of the raid, and he kept saying, I'm having a heart attack, I need medical help, I need to take medicine, I need my water, please let me take my medicine.
Wow.
And they admitted on videotape, and that's part of the documentary, that they would not let him have water or medicine, and they told the ambulance to leave, that they were no longer needed. So my dad had an untreated heart attack sitting in the sun for over an hour, handcuffed, and they were just laughing at him. And when my father was in the hospital, he recorded a video statement to talk about the raid and what they did to him during the raid and an inhumane and barbaric way that he was treated. And that the next day after he recorded his statement, he unfortunately passed away. And
Do you think there was a connection between the events and your father's death?
Direct connection, because the doctor explained to me when my dad was in the hospital that part of his heart tissue died, because when a person doesn't get oxygen, when they don't get their emergency assistance when they're having a heart attack, and they don't get oxygen, their heart tissue begins to die, and so over half of my father's heart tissue had died because of the untreated heart attack. So yes, it's directly related.
Wow. Could you sue the government for this, or is that off limits?
We did. They settled with us 2 weeks before the trial. They did not want the jury to hear about this.
Right. Well, you know, as amazing as all this sounds, the thing that really gets me is that they falsely claimed you served in the Russian army and was a convicted murderer. Is that correct?
That's correct. They had in order to justify this excessive firepower that they brought, their assault weapons that were aimed actually when they thought that my mother was me, they had her on the ground with the laser sight was pointed at her forehead, and only when she said, "I'm not Julia Davis," did they take that off. So to justify that kind of action, what they did is they lied in writing in their report and said that I'm armed and dangerous, and that it is due to my extensive weapons training, including their claim that I served in the Russian army. And funny enough, I never even lived in Russia, much less served in the army.
That's very true. Willie and I are both Ukrainian, and we know that there's a difference between Russia and the Ukraine.
Absolutely.
On that. And you could have probably been living before doing that before the breakup of the Soviet Union, but afterwards, definitely not. On that, which is really amazing, on that, and so all this went on. How are you holding up? I mean, the stress must have been just unbelievable. You can't go anywhere for help. Your family, not just you, are being literally destroyed. And so, how did you hold up with all of this?
Because of friends and family. That's what really made it. A situation that we just kept on fighting back until we prevailed. That's what it all comes to, is having that core, your family and good friends who stand by you while all of this is happening and mm-hmm. help in every way they can. And that's what got us through. It definitely was beyond stressful, and which is exactly their goal. They want to exhaust. The whistleblower mentally, physically, financially drained their resources. They levied our bank accounts, thinking that we wouldn't be able to bail out of prison or hire attorneys. So there's a number of actions. We were attacked on every front, literally every aspect of our life.
Yeah, Ronnie, I got one
go ahead,
Julia, please. Julia, how does Homeland Security determine a credible terrorist threat? There must be a criteria that you could describe briefly to the audience.
Well, I would say that credible criteria would be based on intelligence reports, and it's usually based on years of investigation, and there has to be some kind of action that they could point to that the person is actually plotting some kind of a terrorist act or is making terrorist threats. But the way the system is set up, at least when we were going through this, I hope something has changed since that point, it was just one of them throwing the idea out there, well, I consider this person to be a domestic terrorist, and pretty much that's all it took. Their superiors signed off on it because I was the whistleblower that they wanted to destroy, and there was no system of checks and balances. They say so, and therefore it goes.
Right. Well, going through all this, did it shake your faith in the country, in our system, and how it operates, and its fairness and justice and all that?
I had come to learn that there is very little justice in the justice system, although I found that there definitely are some good judges, which is why I'm still here and talking to you right now, is because they were judges who read the material, said they were amazed at what the government was doing, called their actions illegal, and ruled in my favor on several occasions. So there are good people in the system, but where the problem lies is that while the administrations change, heads of federal agencies remain the same. And it's the same system of the good old boys that has a grip on the different federal agencies. So it doesn't really matter who's in the position of power, because they're not replacing that power base that continues everything just the way they were.
Perpetuating itself. Willie, let's take a short break, and we'll go into the last part of the show.
Yep, you bet, Ronnie. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Harib. Now back to Ron Chapsick and our fascinating guest, intriguing guest, Julia Davis, for the remainder of the program.
Right, we're back with Julia Davis in this fascinating interview. Again, we remind you, you can go to www.whistleblowers.org to learn more about the work of the association that Julia is associated with, her movie Top Priority, The Terror Within, documentary that's award-winning, and it's going to be available pretty soon. And Julia, can you give us the website again, please?
toppriorityemovie.com.
On that, and in the end, you were vindicated, right? Files were found within Osama bin Laden's compound in 2011. Talk about that, and what happened as a result of that.
During the raid, when the contents for some of the files in bin Laden's compound was released, they found a mention of 4th of July as being the date that the potential terrorist attacks or penetration was being considered. So, in fact, the intelligence alert that we initially had that I had acted upon seemed to have been perfectly valid. And as a matter of fact, if the Homeland Security just investigated my report instead of investigating me, no one probably would have even known that this had happened, because it was never my intention to embarrass the agency or do anything
right.
Like that. I just wanted this suspicious events to be investigated. But my report about the 4th of July was closed on the same day that it was open. And on the closing report, it says closed with no investigation and no action. So 2 days that was never investigated, but they had spent millions of taxpayers' dollars investigating and prosecuting me.
Right. But eventually you won in court, right?
Yeah. Once false criminal charges against my husband and I were dismissed with a finding of factual innocence, we sued Homeland Security, and my mom also had sued for the wrongful death of my dad. So those lawsuits were proceeding together, and 2 weeks before the trial, Homeland Security offered to settle the cases, which we did. And,
right. Did you ever get an apology for what you had to go through? When in the end, you were proven right?
I was proven right, but I don't think government officials are in the habit of acknowledging doing anything wrong, and
right.
So I'm not holding my breath on that, because they had promoted the main perpetrators, and I see their perverted logic beyond that, because if they were to fire them, then they would be admitting how badly they had messed up.
Right.
So as long as they keep them on, they could say, well, no, they didn't do anything wrong, and she's the bad guy. And they're pretty much, their main focus is just to keep the story quiet. They don't want to talk about it.
Right. I worked in a bureaucracy for more than 2 decades, university, so I know how it works on that. And your story is on a much bigger scale, but it's still classic in terms of what happens when you go up against the powers that be. But, you know, your story is really underreported. I didn't really, saw this story anywhere prominently. I just sort of stumbled on it. And I understand that the Homeland Security is still trying to suppress your story. Is that correct?
That's correct. When I was on the Alex Jones show was the big breakthrough, when a lot of people have learned about the story, because CBS actually interviewed my husband and I at our home in 2011. They had the airing date set. That was actually set for my birthday in 2011,
right,
in May. And then they just set on the story after hours and hours of filming. It was the airing date. Everything was set in place. And then they were told from somewhere on high, don't go forward with it. And the big tobacco whistleblower, Jeffrey Wigand, the same happened to him. They interviewed him, and then they sat on their interview, and only when the feature film with Russell Crowe came out did they finally air the interview. So there's definitely direct connections between the mainstream media outlets and the government. They can tell them what story to run with and which one to sit on, and
right. They're
definitely the ones to keep the story hidden.
Julian Assange is in the holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy, and he's been gone after by the government. Do you feel anything in common with him and his story? And do you think that he's got a case when he says that he's being harassed?
Well, absolutely. The principle is the same. Somebody exposes something that they want to keep hidden, and instead of addressing what they have exposed, they charge them with something irrelevant. Like in his case, they're claiming there's sexual charges. So it's exactly the same principle. They want to avoid talking about the topics that he had, you know, exposed, but they want to attack him in other covert ways. Right. And it's actually a method that was invented during the Nixon administration, and that's one of the papers that I'm going to publish along with my book that should be coming out later this year. It's called the Malik Manual, and it was created during the Nixon administration as a guideline for what to do with people who blow the whistle, who talk too much, who think in a way inconsistent with the way the leaders of the organization would like them to think. And the tactics for dealing with them are to transfer them, demote them, give them bad ratings, and investigate them for so many things that they can't stand it and they leave, or in the best case scenario for the agency to prosecute them, put them in prison, and at that point, who's going to listen to them?
Wow. Well, we really look forward to your book. I'd like to have you back on the show because it's such an important story next year sometime. But, you know, this begs the question, what kind of impact do you think the Patriot Acts had on U.S. democracy? Because obviously, you know, this all stems from the Patriot Act, right? Some of the requirements that were implemented after 9/11.
Yes, the Patriot Act that eliminated the system of checks and balances where several layers of government agency had to sign off on authorizing surveillance or searches, wiretaps, and the Patriot Act eliminated all of that. And pretty much any agent can come to his supervisor, have him sign a paper saying, okay, go look into this person, and they're free to do what they will. So it's completely unconstitutional piece of legislation that doesn't need to be in existence, because instead of being used to combat terrorism, it's being used to terrorize patriotic Americans.
Right. So we're sacrificing freedom for security.
Yes.
Right, on that. And, you know, a lot of people have a negative view of whistleblowers. You know, they equate them with, so-called snitches and all that, even though you're doing it for a very noble reason. Now, how do you answer these people?
I think that instead of repeating what they hear on the mainstream media, they need to read those individual cases. And when they see what the motivation of each particular whistleblower is, they will see they were all striving to do the right thing and protect the public at large. Mm-hmm. And they risk their lives and their careers to do so. So I think the motive tells it all. And also, a majority of cases of fraud in every arena of life in the United States and in the world is only being addressed is because of whistleblowers. If whistleblowers didn't come forward, most cases of fraud and corruption would never have been unearthed.
That's right. Now, we only got a few seconds, about a minute. Are there enough places are there enough laws in place to protect whistleblowers? Are they vulnerable?
Whistleblowers are completely vulnerable. The Whistleblower Protection Act is toothless and actually had given more power to the federal agencies to retaliate against whistleblowers. And the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act has very serious loopholes in it that the group that I'm affiliated with, National Whistleblower Center, they are working hard to eliminate those glaring loopholes that would actually make it even easier for the agencies to throw the cases of whistleblowers out of court without a hearing. So there are very serious problems with it. As it stands right now, whistleblowers are not protected. They're left wide open.
Well, we think you're doing great work, and we're really honored to have you on our show and to share your chilling story. And we wish you good luck with your work, Julia, and we hope to have you back on when your book comes out.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be on the show, and thank you guys for all the great work you're doing, bringing truth forward, and I appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to the next time.
Okay, until we see each other again. Thank you very much then, Julia.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Julia. Great interview. Thank you very much. Well, Ronnie, thanks, and special thanks again to our featured guest, Julia Davis. It was a fascinating interview, a lot of insights here. We're delighted to have her on our broadcast. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about the interview tonight?
Yeah, when you talk about patriotism, I think they got to talk about Julia Davis, because this, to me, is the true patriot, someone that sees something wrong with their country and goes about trying to correct it, not just blindly waving the flag. And she's an amazing woman, because she went through all this and is a survivor,
right?
Obviously. And we're sorry about her father and the impact on her family, but we wish her luck with her work. How about you, Willie?
Well, you know, Ronnie, I learned that Julia Davis, she doesn't scare easy, man. She's a tough-as-nails crusader on all failures of Homeland Security, and she persevered. You know, she really persevered through the court system to come out on top with the witch hunt. It was simply a witch hunt by the Department of Homeland Security they waged. She's quite the lady and a great role model. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beats Moment in Time segment. Well, this one goes back 173 years, August 21st, 1831. A slave version of U.S. Independence Day on July the 4th that year was postponed when Nat Turner, a black preacher, fell ill. 7 weeks later, he and six fellow slaves began a murderous march through Virginia. Over 2 days, they and dozens of others killed at least 55 white people. Hundreds of blacks were killed in reprisals. 2 months later, Nat Turner was captured, fried, and hanged, and then skinned. Your comments on this very dark day in history, Ronnie?
Well, you know, I was a history major, got a degree in history and all that, so I studied this as part of Southern history, and it was really one of the most seminal events leading up to the Civil War. In the aftermath of this incident, all kinds of laws were passed to make it unlawful to teach slaves, as well as not only slaves, but also blacks to read and write. And there were reprisals on the other end. You know, people forget that 200 blacks were also killed.
That's
a lot
right.
of them innocent, you know, just caught up in the frenzy and the rage that resulted from Nat Turner. Nat Turner, and he's a controversial figure in U.S. history today.
Amazing time.
What about you, Willie?
Well, amazing time in history, and Nat Turner, he did a lot of bad stuff, but, I guess there was a reason for that madness. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for August the 30th, where Crime Beat welcomes Mara Shalop, a journalist who discusses a riveting book about the Black Mafia family. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. Now, we hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to all our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope to tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.
I'm gonna need some.